Yes, we look in Advent to an uncertain future. In Advent, we call it eschatology. But we're going to look at the future now, and one of you have already broached one subject, which we'll get to right away as soon as I've made a brief introduction into our problems. The first one that we've talked about here before, I call them, the problems, the five B's and a C, which is the bomb, bulldozers, babies, bread, baloney. And related to baloney is C, credibility, or the lack of credibility of our leaders. And we might start with that first. And it wasn't long ago that a survey was taken when Nixon was still president of the credibility of a college of university students, and less than half of them were interested at all in government. The president at that time had a confidence rating of less than 30, but also disturbing was that the Congress, the senators and representatives too, were about 30%. And when you come to that, your democracy is in jeopardy. So that is a great concern. We can go back to the B's, starting with the first one, and I won't get much into that today, but we have discussed around the tables here during my stay here, and I guess almost every time I come, as soon as people hear that I spent a good part of my life in nuclear energy programs, in my case looking at the bioenvironmental impact of energy effluence, or energy generating systems in which there's effluence possible, emphasizing the nuclear. It happens to be a system in which we have done more work than any of the others, and we know more about it, and also there's still more fear regarding it. But the concern is with the bomb. It has to do with, of course, a nuclear exchange with the major powers and also the minor ones. The concern in this regard now is that probably more governments, more countries will have them, and some of them are not known for their stability. I have in reference here now, India most recently had developed a peacetime bomb after Canada made available to them a nuclear power. And when you have nuclear power and uranium, you do, of course, produce plutonium, which is a fissionable material, plutonium-239. And if you have a sufficient expertise, you can separate out the plutonium, and from there on you can at least build a Hiroshima-type bomb. A lot of people know how to build one of those if you've taken popular mechanics. And it doesn't really take much expertise, but it does take a lot of technology to separate out the plutonium. But this is available now in more countries. Egypt now has been promised a nuclear reactor and nuclear power by Nixon. Israel probably is well on the way, may in fact already have some fissionable material suitable for a device. Argentina is well on the way, and many others. And some of these people may become quite irresponsible and then go to using them. The other concern is the in this age of banditry, to have some of this fissionable material in its travels about to be removed and utilized in nuclear devices that are explosives. And this is of some concern, although the kind of material that you have in reactors, it isn't something you can take into your basement and build an atomic bomb. You've got to have the separation facilities for it, unless you have the military grade of material. And that's completely different from that used in nuclear power reactors. So I want you to remember that. You can't have a nuclear power reactor and blow up like an atomic bomb. It's impossible. Or you steal it You can't make a bomb out of it unless you have rather elaborate apparatus to separate out the material. But the concern is that some third world power or a group who wish to threaten the rest of the world or make them do something they would not do, such as to America say, if you don't behave yourself, if you don't give us this amount of food for our people or whatever it might be, we will blow up one of your major cities. And you can just drive it into the city in some small vehicle, and you don't know which one it is, and so you're afraid, and you will then relent. However, there is a difficulty with this. If there's a third world power that's defined, they must have the concern for retaliation. And that's one of the overriding things as far as the bomb goes. Now, I'm not going to say anything more about that unless there are questions. The bulldozer thing has to do with the energy thing. And we do face a very serious problem. We cannot go on like we are. I have told this to a lot of people for the last 10 years. We just can't keep buying the kind of cars and utilizing the kind of cars we have in the numbers we have, because the gasoline and the oil that's utilized for this is just in so limited supply and probably utilizable for so many more important things that we cannot go on doing this. And this has to change, and it has to change very soon. And Gerry Ford is frankly very foolish not to go along this. Now, I realize he's probably playing the political game, and very shortly will come out with a program that will call for very stringent measures relative to the use of the hydrocarbon fuels. Unfortunately, we have not been wise in the past relative to our investment in research for other forms, systems of energy. Certainly nuclear energy has a lot of promise. A lot of people are concerned about it. I think those that are most concerned about it know the least about it. But there is some concern. I point out in this regard that there is no system that operates without risk. You took risk coming here. Certainly one of the biggest risks today is driving an automobile. We lose millions and millions on the highways each year. Many people you don't see, but who are injured for life or at least for a long time, in addition to the 60,000 killed a year. It'll be a little less this year because we've decided to go a little slower, not drive quite as much. We say we should turn to coal and bag the nuclear bit until we can develop either fusion power, like the sun, a miniature sun, or to go to solar. Both of those have big problems. We have grown up in an age in which we expect a miracle every Monday morning. You most of you who are younger have been raised on instant breakfast food, instant this, instant that. It's a miracle almost every week. And a lot of people think you can have for a lady to have a baby, it takes 9 months of gestation. There are many people who would apply this to our energy situation and say, well, if one woman takes 9 months to have a baby, you can take nine women and raise one in a month. It doesn't work that way. There is a period of gestation that is required, and we won't have any of these things on a line to any extent for many, many years, if in fact at all in an extensive system. There are still big problems technologically relative to fusion power. And we have to turn more to non-contaminating or less contaminating materials, probably and certainly far more efficient systems for energy generation, and utilize then some of the things that are renewable or available. Wind power can be used in some areas, probably geothermal. Certainly wood is a renewable resource, and we were talking last night Some of us who have concern and responsibilities within the village about what the things we can do here to save power and look to the future for saving hydrocarbon fuel, among other things. So we have a real problem here as far as our gas supplies, our natural gas. I have been concerned as a consultant to the Atomic Energy Commission relative to looking for other sources of natural gas by detonating nuclear devices underground. We've had now three shots in the west. The first one was Gas Buggy, Arulasan, and Rio Blanco. And the last one was not the success we'd hoped. It was the first multiple shot. But there is real concern whether this is the route to go. And even if it was successful, we would probably only increase our gas reserves about 10 years. We probably have in the United States probably a reserve of less than 10 years right now at the present utilization. So I wouldn't invest big in gas burners, although there is some possibility that we will buy it liquefied from other countries at a very enormous price and haul it in. But you'll pay dearly for it. And it's probably better utilized for some other things, such as making fertilizer to face this problem of hunger, which is an overwhelming thing. I won't go much into it, because I think if you've read the lay press at all, you realize we are facing a desperate situation relative to food. In the Bangladesh area, in India itself said 2 years ago, now we've licked this problem with the Green Revolution, and we're going to take care of it and export. And some of these countries who are considering that, and in fact look like they're going to make it, are now in a desperate situation. This includes India, because you have to realize our Green Revolution was based on the development of cereal crops that were bred to respond remarkably to a high input of water and fertilizer, commercial fertilizer, high nitrogen intake. And this was based on the availability of a cheap source of hydrocarbon fuel. And that ain't no more. It just ain't no more. And so they cannot afford it. And what this whole program is hitting probably are the third world countries, in which they were just on the verge of doing something for themselves relative to food production with these new kind of grains and a high input of fertilizer, and then to find that they become suddenly dear and they cannot afford them. So it has become a very desperate situation, and with the population growth as it is growing faster than our ability to raise the food to feed them. If the population goes like this, the ability to increase the food supply is down here, and it's becoming more disparate. And so we face a very critical situation in your lifetime, if not in this decade, of millions starving. And it's a question, how many people can starve before you run into very serious problems, politically and otherwise? So that is a very deep concern. And what we were talking about, and what I mentioned yesterday, was the problem raised relative to my expression of the need for animals. That you've seen a lot in the lay press recently that says that we just well get rid of all the livestock. We can't have... We can't be utilizing cereal crops for input into cattle because of the loss in energy. For right now, if you're going to produce a beef cow or a steer, and you take it and put it in a feed yard and give it the concentrates, you are probably bringing it up to prime grade, and the fat that requires, it's more than a loss of a 9-to-1 ratio of the energy input to 1 pound of protein or 1 pound of meat in red meat. It's even higher than that when you consider the finish on it. And this, of course, is ridiculous. It's ridiculous for very many reasons. There is some question right now, although it has not been proven. And I was just 2 weeks ago at the National Academy on a discussion in a symposium on this subject of fat on meat. And there is now a move to change the grading of cattle. And this is very much needed, because some people have recently shown that tenderness and juiciness of meat is not completely related to the amount of marbling and fat on the animal. In fact, you and I have probably realized that you can have a very nice piece of meat, that is a red meat that is very lean and very tender, and have little fat on it. And there are some cattle in the world that tend toward this. In fact, there was a study recently at the University of Florida by my old mentor in animal nutrition, his associates showed that the relationship of marbling and fatness related to tenderness and juiciness was only about a 5 to 10% contribution. It's probably more related to genetics. Now, the discussion we had and that I talked about yesterday was that it's ridiculous to talk about eliminating cattle, especially the ruminants. The ruminants have the ability to eat cellulose, a material that is not usable or useful for food for either the monogastric animals, such as the pig and the chicken and things like that, or for people. They can use high browse or poor type of grasses that we can't use, and they can convert. They're very efficient converters of this. In fact, we have some interesting experiments. Washington State University now, by Irv Dyer and his associates, They're feeding wood chips in high amounts to cattle and producing pretty good meat with it. So these are very exciting times in this regard. And what we propose then, and in fact I've already proposed it, and others have too, and it goes like this. We have to produce some ruminants and utilizing cattle too, in which they can do exceedingly well in being producers of red meat that is very lean yet tender and juicy on roughage, pretty much essentially grazing and browse. There are such cattle in existence now. It's a matter of selecting them, and we have the means for producing them really quite rapidly now, because we have made some real advances. In fact, one of the leading places in the world right now in this is my hometown of Stanwood, Washington, and called Bova Transplant. And what they do is to take a very select cow, and they treat it in a certain way so that it produces more than one egg, which is then fertilized, producing several embryos. It hasn't been fully developed. You'd like to have about 6 to 8 embryos. If you produce more than that, their success rate isn't so good. But if you could produce 6 and 8, and then you remove them from the cow and put them in 6 sort of grade cows, they're just sort of the incubator for them. And that way you can produce some very good stock in a short time. And they have been successful in this. What we need to do is to be able to preserve them so that you can have them, and so you don't need as many cows, because you need, and they have 400 or 500 cows, so that you always have some of them in estrus so that they are receptive to the implantation of the embryo. And in fact, I was just in discussions with a person from AID, the That's the Organization for International Development, Agency for International Development, and to try to get a contract between us and Bova Transplant in Africa. Now, I don't know if it'll come about, but this is one of the things we're looking at. I know in Florida, my old mentor is also looking at this, to select out stock and then develop them very rapidly that will produce good red meat on a high input of roughage with very little cereal grain. In fact, you can probably select one so that you can have it pretty much a high cellulose diet with just enough cereal grain in it so that the addition of the cereal grain, you might get a one-to-one kind of ratio, that with the addition of that 1 pound of grain, you are really gaining. You are not losing calorically, and you're gaining protein-wise. So it is not a lost cause. And what we'd like to do initially, of course, is to upgrade some of the foreign stock. And in this regard, what we'd like to do is be able to preserve them so you can take the embryo here and fly it over and put it in the livestock there and produce it there. At the same time, I'd like to get some of the so-called cattle or the water buffalo in that area over here. But that presents a problem because of the exotic diseases that occur there that we as veterinarians work very hard at preventing their introduction into this country. It would be catastrophic for our industry if things like rinderpest and foot and mouth disease and such things were introduced. And so we have very strict limitations on this, but there are means probably to introduce them via our Plum Island facility off of Long Island, where research on exotic diseases are performed. So that, in answer to your question, is the direction we are going here. And I reminded most of you, I guess, that as one examines our land mass, there are probably 7%, there's probably 7% of our land mass that is cultivatable and useful for crops. 2% of it is really good, and some of the rest is perhaps marginal. But over 50% of the land mass is reasonable for grazing, but not useful for cropping. And this probably is best utilized then for the kind of livestock I'm talking about, for producing animal protein. And I'd say that even if I were not a veterinarian. And many other people now are coming to that. But you have been misled, I think, by one of the other bees, by the baloney that exists. There is so much misinformation today. The trouble ain't that people don't know anything. The trouble is that most of what they know ain't true. That's one of my laws. Another one states that you can't tell people what they need to know because they want to know something else. So that is a very big issue. Another thing that I'm really red hot on right now and been pushing for quite a while has to do with land use. And this is a critical issue that's facing our country. It's very disturbing to many people who own large parcels of land or small parcels of land or land on the seacoast, which is very dear. In fact, I was in an interesting discussion. I spoke at the... they brought me to Lewiston, to Idaho, to present to be there for the presentation of the Grassman Award. And I gave him my bit on land use and knowing full well what would happen. And one of the people came up afterward and he said, "Hey, I have a pretty good talk, but I certainly have some different opinion with you." It turned out he had several thousands of acres down the Snake. And I don't want anybody to tell me what I'm going to do with my land. That's mine. I says, "Yes, it's probably yours for a few years. But what about the people after you?" I said, "Also, I guess you wouldn't want anybody to put up a rendering plant next to your house or across the road." No. Well, they can't put it next to me. I own that land. I says, how about across the road? Well, we got regulations for that. I says, yeah, that regulates the land use, doesn't it? And I said that the kind of practices you have on your land certainly determines its utilizability for future generations. And it is not fair nor right for you to have cropping practices which deplete the land or in other form causes erosion and the loss of the land. I recalled for them the Tigris and Euphrates, which at one time were one of the most fertile areas of the world, is now desert. And there's a good reason for that, and it was bad practice, irrigation and land management. It wasn't long ago that I was in my consultant status with Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory and visited around in that area again, and visited some of the Native American situations. And that whole area in there, although it's kind of interesting to drive through, it's essentially non-productive as land. Yet one time it was very good grazing area, but they overgrazed it and mishandled it. I was shocked in coming back to the Palouse country in Pullman. Whitman County raises more wheat than any other county in all the world. And it was the worst erosion I have ever seen in that whole area in my life. Yet they know how to manage the land. We knew that when I went to school there at the time and before the big war. Yet literally thousands of tons of that land went down the river this year. Big deep gullies in the hillsides. If you fly over it, many of the tops are bare. They do not produce. And this is a great tragedy. We cannot continue that as a people. It is not fair to those who follow us or for the long-term survival. Or when I drive, every time I drive through the valley, the Kent Valley, I get sick. Because there I see the whole Boeing sprawl out there on some of the finest land in Washington. It's on top of 5 feet of gravel and blacktop, where you could have moved it a few miles into the rocky hills, which are not very productive at all. Now, we can't go on this way. I guess during the next 10 years, what do? We blacktop and essentially eliminate from a productive land about the size of the state of New Jersey. And there are just so many states of New Jersey that are available. Not to say that much of New Jersey might not be helped by covering it over with blacktop, from much of what I've seen of it, but there's still hope for some of it, I guess. But this is a serious, serious problem. And you who are in forestry, we have to relook at this situation. We have gone through much of our land, and it goes back to now the Palouse, in areas where I used to hunt and now I watch birds. They have cleaned out all the streams, removed all the brush and the trees from all the gullies. And this removes, of course, the cover for animals, but it also makes the land far more vulnerable to erosion. And maybe a better utilization of some of this is to plant the right kind of tree, to develop maybe a faster-growing tree that might be a source then of wood alcohol, which if put into our gas tank right now at about 12% of the gasoline, would result in far more efficient utilization of the motor, a less pollution, and really a more effective and efficient car. And it's renewable, of course. So we have a great challenge before us relative to what we can do, and that's why what makes it such an exciting time. But in the whole land use issue, we have to go through it and say not to look at what it is, what we can do in the next 2 years or 4 years. See, most of our planning, long-term planning today, is defined, I think, as the term of a senator. That's 6 years. More so on a four-year basis, which is the term of a president. That's long-term planning, because that's built into the system. Where in reality, we ought to be looking at 50 and 100 years down the line. With these kind of cropping practices, we cannot continue. Maybe we can't continue, such as in the Palouse, producing this wheat the way we are. Maybe we'll have to put more of it into grass that holds the soil for the long-term survival of this land. With these kind of cropping practices, we cannot continue. Maybe we can't continue, such as in the Palouse, producing this wheat the way we are. Maybe we'll have to put more of it into grass that holds the soil for the long-term survival of this land, or to develop new kind of crops, and maybe to put... And this will call for some of these livestock I'm talking about. And with the input of all these, many of these fertilizers and the herbicides and all, we have to look at the long-term effect of these. Not there in the Palouse, but when it's all collected, washed down, and the whole area then of the whole riverbed to the ocean. A lot of people says, well, we'll be saved by the ocean. We'll be saved by the ocean because we haven't really fully utilized the ocean. Yet the ocean is much like the Sahara Desert, non-productive. And incidentally, the Sahara Desert is expanding at the rate of about 2 miles a year south. And some of the area in Africa that has now undergone drought for over 2 years, although they've gotten some rain recently, is probably ruined in great part. Because, again, of faulty management practices along with the lack of rainfall. But the ocean is much of it is a desert. The productive areas of the ocean are near the coast. And in the estuaries, which we keep messing up, and a lot of the stuff we run down the river messes up the coastline and in many cases makes it less productive. It's a very vulnerable area and very fragile. So we have to really take a hard look at this and manage it far better, to be better stewards than we are. And we lack, of course, information in this, and I keep making an appeal. Admittedly, I'm prejudiced in this regard because I'm basically an experimentalist. I've spent most of my life in laboratories, in looking at problems and trying to solve them. But we have been deficient in our investment into knowledge in this regard. There's so much we do not know about the long-term effects of certain management practices. We will have to go back maybe to the old manure spreader that I used and manned as a child, and to go to rotation for nitrogen fixation, because there are certain crops that fix nitrogen in the soil to then save you having to put nitrogen fertilizers on there, which are becoming very dear. So these are the kind of things that we're looking at. And now I think we should throw it open for discussion, because my Russian tea is now cool enough to drink.
Yes. Well, what could be done about stopping spread of say suburbs out on the farmland?
Yes. I've talked with legislators about this, and you can't do it completely on a local level, because political systems being what they are, and the power systems being what they are, this is usually not successful. But we have to have, I think, legislation regarding it. And whether you and I like it or not, we cannot continue having sort of single-unit housing. If the population keeps going like it is, it's an impossibility to go this route. And you can do it by certain tax structuring. And this is where we need a lot of study on tax structuring and actual denial of this. Have sort of the green belt kind of a thing. And you see, now you can't blame the people because, you know, you get terrific prices for this. And so you go that route. And I've argued with economists on this. They say, well, when it becomes valuable enough to put in farmland, you will. Now, you can't tell me you're going to get desperate for farmland and move that whole Boeing mess out of the Kent Valley and remove the 5 feet of concrete and all of that. Now, you're talking about a lot of money. The same with when we lived in the Sacramento Valley. We were sitting on an acre initially of some of the best land in California. And I've told some of you about this before, and we weren't really utilizing it. We had a lot of trees, and it did help the birds. Susie ate the grapes. That was a dog, and maybe Becky and Carrie got a few of them. It was a waste of this land, and we had a large house on it, and a swimming pool that was heated, and it was just ridiculous. Of the energy we utilized in this land. And we just can't do that anymore. We have to go, I think, to the kind of system that I observed, for example, in Geneva or outside of Finland in their model city, where you go to a sort of condominium or multi-unit type of thing. And I thought the one, I don't know if any of you know Aki and Doris Rolander. They were with Lutheran World Federation, and they're down in, they're back in Bellevue now. He used to be on the award-winning TV show in Seattle before he went back to Lutheran World Federation. He used to be in Tanzania. But they lived in, I thought, a very pleasant unit. I'd be very happy in the kind of unit they had. It was so constructed, so you had some privacy, and you had land around it for multiple use. And you had this sort of the city here, and these are the kind of things we'll have to move to in land that is less productive. In the Sacramento Valley, coming back to that, there are hills near there and not very productive land, which is where they should put the people, and then utilize the land below for agricultural purposes. But what do they do? They're just expanding the area for housing, and the hills are still up there and bare. They put the Sacramento Airport in some of the best rice land around there. It also happened to be the foggiest area in the whole of that area. They could have just moved, 5 or 10 miles up onto sort of a plateau where there's less fog and cheaper land and gravel land. But they didn't. And there was if they would have had the right tax structure and land use policies in force, that's the way they should have gone.
What you're saying, we all hone into an economic structure that ends up with a word called profit.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like we're going to have to rationalize that word of profit and make it more humanitarian.
You hit the nail right on the head. You and I have lived in this kind of, we were raised in this kind of a situation, as you were, Omer, and many of you. I mean, I was with General Electric Company for 15 years, and I understand the capitalistic system.
Well, but even removing that as a factor and going through legislation on a national level is a fantastic conflict around the particular now of the Environmental Protection Agency, which is still considered the home of the air pollution, but its regulations are effectively requiring additional urban sprawl to reduce the pollution in the agricultural area.
Yeah. No, I am not one of the great supporters of EPA. I have a lot of friends there. We still have an insufficient knowledge base. And up until recently, the EPA existed. It was essentially a political organization whose progress was equated to activity. And their activity was chiefly moving moving groups from one part of the country to the other and combining them and moving them about. And that's unfortunately true. And of course, Ruckelhaus, who was at that time planning to run for against Birch Bayh as senator, this is off the record, incidentally, and he was building a political base. And so this is how it's been utilized, and then you get some people who do not take the overall view. Now, my views on the land use bill, on this whole land use, is along the lines of Senator Henry Jackson and the one also that the Nixon administration proposed, and they all came to an agreement on this. It was supported by Business Week, by the Wall Street Journal, by most state governments, and it was, I think, overwhelmingly supported in the Senate, and I think they had a modified bill in the House, and it just made a lot of sense. This is a regionalization thing. I am interested in doing it, not, I think you have to have a national bill and funding, but I think it should be done in a regional sort of a thing, where you have commonality. In fact, I have proposed that for our institution, that they become, in cooperation with, say, Idaho and Oregon, to look at that region for a database and an area planning. I think California should have it. I think we should do it by region. I don't think you need input from the local level. I'm with giving as much authority and responsibility down to the lower levels, realizing, however, what power bases do result in small communities, because it's usually the one who may not be the most intelligent but has the most power. And I'll give you an example of this in Pullman. There, the town fathers as well. You know, there's no reason why we shouldn't have a lot of little acre plots out here scattered around the Whitman County. That makes pleasant living. Well, that's absolutely ridiculous. To break up all that lovely farmland into acre plots here, and there, it makes for a very inefficient farming, and it's a poor utilization of that kind of land. So you have to have something, maybe there above the local level, that does it. And we have very strange regulations, but there's going to have to be a lot of give and take in this, and there are going to be traumatic times, really traumatic times. But we have to have more, I think, whether we like it or not, because of the complexity of our civilization and the numbers of people, we are going to have to compromise in some of these areas. Yes.
What is the big holdback on intensified research solar energy?
Yes. Well, up until recently, and I remember Farrington Daniels and others 20 or 30 years ago said, boy, we got to look at solar energy. The problem with it is that it's a low efficiency source of heat. There are several proposals. The main thing is that they said, well, it's not a high heat source, and it's not dependable because every day isn't sunny. So we'll go to something else. And of course, you have the political and economic constraints there, or the pressures, because oil is the way to go, and it's easy, and so that's the way we went. So politically and all, it was not a supportable kind of a thing. Now it's become more supportable, but it still needs a good deal of research to develop better systems. There are two interesting there are several interesting proposals, two of them on a fairly large scale, and I don't know if the latter one is, the second one is funded, but the first one has been funded to some extent. And this is a proposal to use something like hafnium plates or something, maybe then on a similar line production, that are collector plates over literally hundreds of square miles of desert that would then be collectors, and maybe transfer the heat then to liquid sodium. That was one proposal by the Monells. And then to salt brine, so that you could then build up this heat sink to take you through cloudy days, and then run it just like a conventional plant. This is one proposal. Now I understand it's being funded to some extent, but probably not getting enough. The other proposal has to do with using the kind of collectors we developed in the space program, and we have utilized them, but they're exceedingly expensive, very expensive. But we do produce a good deal, well, some energy in space, and some of the material that's up there now is being powered by them, and also by so-called atomic batteries utilizing things like plutonium-238. But then it's a matter of transfer of, after you collect the energy, how do you transfer it back to Earth? And there isn't a great deal of money, and it's just a matter of limiting the money. The Nixon administration chose their priorities, and they're faced with, of course, a limited amount of money. And what they decided to do was to essentially put the majority of the research money into the breeder reactor, because they felt that in the interim here, probably for the next 100 or so years, 100 to 200 years, that this would be the logical source. To have a breeder reactor where you start out and you really then have you enter a plutonium economy, and you are producing then more plutonium than you're using, and it sounds like a pretty good system. And this is what they chose to do, and they put in, you know, hundreds of million dollars of their research on that. I guess less than $100 million on fusion, thermonuclear, and I don't know, probably just a few. Maybe tens of millions, I don't quote me on this, into solar. We will see more solar utilization, I would predict, that in the next decade, the houses that will hopefully be built, and also large government buildings, if they do it right, will require, at least in certain areas, to build them in such a way so that you are utilizing solar heat a great deal more. Even now, you could build your houses in many parts of this country and utilize solar heat much more than we do now, and effectively for saving. It's a remark, and that's kind of the fun part of it. If we really look into this and see how can we really save this and make that as one of our challenges and one of our goals, it's really quite exciting. For example, I think if some of you have been in Ellensburg, I know Ron's been in Ellensburg, I'm sure Ron and I could design a system that will run all of Ellensburg. You can do it by wind. Huh? It's wind all the time in Ellensburg. Just run it by wind power. Huh? And out west here, utilize geothermal. Maybe you say, well, it doesn't make that big an impact on the whole national situation, but it certainly would take care of a great part of the west if we could utilize this. In Montana, you have hot rocks not too far down. We have it here in the Cascades. We already have a plant north of San Francisco that's operating on geothermal, supplying some electricity for San Francisco. They have them in Italy. But there are many areas here in the West. In Los Alamos, they have a project going. Battelle at Richland, Washington has a project going. They're already checking a feasibility thing, drilling down in Idaho to utilize then these hot rocks that are in the earth. And maybe use a system then where you run the water down, it heats up, and then you've got hot water to run, or hopefully steam that runs a power plant. And it would probably be less contaminating, and it would be a renewable resource. We are going to become a nation of recyclers and using renewable resources. And we have to. We just have to. More bicycles. Bicycles are the greatest thing, greatest means of transportation known to people. Although people are getting very reckless about them now, we're having some serious accidents with them because they've built these 10-speed jet jobs. Yes?
I've heard it said that many appliances, cars included, are just built to last so long.
Yeah. Planned obsolescence. Oh, I think so. fact, it would cost more. And now you're getting into a problem that we should discuss sometime on what will this do to us if we go to this a kind of economy that builds things to last and only builds what we need. Because if we do that, it will only take a very small percentage of our workforce. So then what about the work ethic? What do we do with our time? Well, we go to more service kind of things and art and culture, music, crafty things, I guess. But this brings up a very interesting problem. In fact, the old Maytag, I was in somebody's home. In fact, my bird-watching friend, Rosemary Troxell, has in her basement, and still running it, one of these old Maytags that I know was a 1930 model, maybe. And we have cars. I know that even some of those my car is a 62 Fury that has 113,000 at least on it, and has never been in. Well, it's being into now. In fact, it's been in the shop since July. That shows how much I use it. I was hoping it'd be ready for Christmas, but it wasn't. But it is some major overall now. But and I guess it could have gone quite a ways further. But my wife wouldn't ride with me in it because there was a lot of blue smoke coming out the back end, and the police didn't like it either. So I had to do something about it, but it was running great. But there are, we can build it, and far more simpler. Build them more simple. And we can't keep building electric wax paper dispensers and things like that. And there really are such, no way.
Farmers in South Dakota have a very traumatic problem today. That is a minor traumatic problem compared to the worldwide problem of tens of millions of people starving. These are just the beginning of the trauma we're going to be
Yeah. The whole thing in Ethiopia, for example, the collapse of that government has a lot to do with the availability of food and the mismanagement. And then that's what you're going to see, and it's a very terrible thing. And it's going to be takes much prayer and fasting and a lot of other things. Yeah, a lot of words and one joke that caused butts a lot of trouble. No play the game, no make it the rules. But I talked to some of the people that were there a couple of weeks ago in Washington, and probably the thing, now I haven't gone, I've asked for the papers, but I haven't seen them. But in talking with them, one of the things that came out of it that they feel hopefully will come out of it is a world sort of food bank, not by the United States, or run by us, and I'd rather we didn't involve ourselves. We should be involved in it, but not sort of running it, because it puts you in a very terrible spot. But to have sort of a world food bank where everybody is contributing it and then parceling it out, rather than only on certain political grounds. I don't know if we can come to that, but I hope at least, and the people that were there hope that this would be possible, and I think our own government also feels that this is feasible. Yes, and the thing we have to do with the have-nots, it doesn't help much in the situation if we're like an average of 50 bushels per acre kind of a thing. 50 to even up to in the Palouse, much higher than that, and then have much of the rest of the world at 3 to 5 bushels.
if we can bring them up to 15, it will be a remarkable thing. And that's another thing, you know, to try to make this, some of this technology and management practice available to them so that they can help their own situation and end up contributing to it too. You see, right now, who decides who starves? There are essentially three nations, principally one, and that's the United States, Canada, and Australia. That's essentially who decides who's going to starve, because 1 acre out of every 5 of ours goes to feed somebody else. It's getting to be probably a little less than that. And if we go into another cycle of the Dust Bowl and a lack of rain in the Midwest, in the Southwest, as we have through, I guess, cycles of about 25 to 30 years, it will be catastrophic sooner. Catastrophic. But, yeah, wait, Omar is next. He's been trying to get the floor, and then we'll come to you.
Well, I didn't have too much to go on, and I don't want to take too much of your time, but concerns me with one observation I'd like to make a comment. That is that we do a lot of things because of lack of knowledge in the U.S. except that we do still need knowledge. But how can we better utilize the information that we already have from people who do know and work it through the system so that we can get better action? Now, to say AMA, they have a good organization. We are told that they get their opinion itself. Okay, you can get their opinion.
Yeah.
Disseminate it and respect it
to
get more action.
Yeah, and you bring up a very serious problem that does bother a lot of scientists, and a lot of the scientists are very happy. It's non-threatening, this whole thing of escape I discussed last night. It's fun to be in your laboratory and do all of these things. It's tough to go out there and take the assault. It really is. It's no fun at all, and then have the papers interview you, and then misquote you, and it just wheels you off. And I know some of them, they refuse absolutely to talk to newspaper people. But it's a risk we have to take. It's just like one of you recalled what Carol Hinnerly said: "You can't help anybody that can't hurt you." And so we have to take that risk. The other thing that I included in my proposal, at least my suggestions to our people in the Land Use Institute, is to develop this data bank that's available, and to build up this scientific base for our legislators. I've only recently become politically active because of my position. I have to be to inform those who make the rules and to legislate. And the entry there, it's fine to talk to them, but it's far more important to talk to their staff, because they can't know all this. So you learn to know the staff of the legislators and to feed them the information. And more we're getting on to this now. There's a group of scientists, for example, in the medical community who are contributing money to show them how research pays. You can start with a thing like polio, for example, and show that with this kind of investment has been repaid, and not maybe a thousandfold, but maybe a millionfold from what it would have cost. If you go on having polio, you can keep building bigger and bigger iron lungs. But there's a better way to do it, and that's to prevent it. And we have to go more and more of that in the biomedical community. In the biomedical community, you mentioned AMA. Right now, about 7.8% of our gross national product is going into health care. Probably less than 10% is going into prevention. We're still building bigger and bigger fire engines, bigger and bigger cancer centers, bigger and bigger, you know, treatment centers, heart transplant, you know, all of this, where we ought to spend more of this in the prevention. Some of you and I were raised at a time when we kept building bigger and bigger sanatoriums. We all had friends who went to the SAM. Well, we don't have SANs anymore. That meant you went to the sanatorium to be treated for tuberculosis. We've essentially prevented it. It's true for many of the other diseases. We got the tough ones left. But that doesn't keep us from doing it. And by the same token, we have to
become more politically active to instruct these legislators. The more I see of the legislators, the more compassion I have for them, that they have to make decisions. Most of us just, the only time they hear from us is when we give them hell. Huh? Oh, you stupid jerk, you know, why did you do this? Instead of tell them sometimes when they do something right, but better yet, inform them, but have established credibility. Boy, I'm very careful when I tell him something because I want to make sure it's right. Otherwise, he ain't got time to pay any more attention to people that give him the wrong information.
At what point would you advocate using sort of a political club to impose requirements for population control or the cattle control?
Boy, that's a tough problem I've really wrestled with. And I'm glad I don't have to make the decision at this stage. As you know, and you bring up a very critical issue, and that's India. And I've asked a lot of people in the last few years, is there any hope for India? And these are knowledgeable people, and they say there's no hope for India. Because of their situation, which is very complex. 35% of their food that either comes to the dockside or is raised never gets to people's mouth, because there's probably 9 rats for every person in India, and because they don't have a good distribution system, so it spoils the dockside or it spoils along the way, and then they have all these cows. They don't want to kill a rat. They don't want to kill any of these things that might be their grandmother.